This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago, getting a firsthand look at the wildfire destruction on Maui. President Biden tells those who live there,
"For as long as it takes, we're going to be with you. The whole country will be with you."
At least 114 people are confirmed dead. From more from CBS's Jordan Segundo on Maui.
The Maui County Mayor now says 850 people are listed as officially missing. He's thanking the FBI and local police for locating 1,200 individuals.
We are both saddened and relieved about these numbers as we continue the recovery process.
Almost 2 weeks after the wildfire, some 2,000 people are without electricity and water on parts of the island is not safe to drink. Tropical storm Hillary's Wrath hit California with record-breaking rains in some places, as much as a year's worth. CBS's Carter Evans in the L.A. area, where roads are flooded and covered in mud.
Neighborhoods buried in several inches of mud and residents left knee-deep in aggravation. Hillary packed a wallop for a region that last saw a tropical storm 84 years ago. Boulders tumbled. Across Southern California, many tried to drive on flooded roads, some that turned into muck.
I am trapped.
Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott is joined at the U.S.-Mexico border by four other GOP governors to discuss his administration's Operation Lone Star border policies. The Justice Department is suing the state amid reports of civil and human rights abuses connected to the program. But Governor Abbott insists,
"The border between the United States and Mexico is turning into a deadly welcome mat for the migrants who are coming here."
Abbott blames deaths at the border on the Biden administration. Family members of many 9/11 victims say they do not want to see a plea deal involving those allegedly behind the terror attacks.
"It is our fervent hope you will once again stand up for the victims." Those words in a letter to President Biden from more than 2,000 9/11 family members and survivors. It's after the Pentagon last week sent a letter to the families revealing plea deals are being considered, in which the five men would accept responsibility and plead guilty in exchange for not receiving the death penalty. Plea deals would eliminate the public trials of the men, yet families say they are still waiting to see phone records and other documents that could shed light on that fateful day. Matt Piper, CBS News, New York.
British neonatal nurse Lucy Letby receives a sentence of life without parole after being convicted of murdering seven babies and trying to kill six others at a Northern England hospital. Judge James Goss.
"This was a cruel, calculated, and cynical campaign of child murder involving the smallest and most vulnerable of children."
This is CBS News.
If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Their end-to-end hiring system helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Missed your favorite show? It's easy to find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Apple, Google, or civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly. According to WQOW, the city of Eau Claire has filed a lawsuit against companies that manufacture PFAS, often referred to as forever chemicals, after PFAS were detected in the Eau Claire groundwater. The city of Eau Claire was forced to shut down nearly half of its wells and could spend over $20 million constructing maintenance infrastructure and new treatment facilities. According to WXOW, following the illegal release of thousands of mink from a farm in Trumbull County, animal experts are warning that if the mink aren't recaptured soon, they will most likely die. So far, around 2,000 of the 3,000 released mink have been caught, although their condition has not been made known. Linda Maritek, who runs a rescue for farm-raised animals in Utah, stated, "We don't want to release these animals en masse because it has so many negatives. Those mink are not saved when you release them like that. You have just signed their death sentence." For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly.
Call your local Bug Tussle rep today to find out how you can get free internet service. For Wapaka, Wishara, Outagamie, Winnebago, Marquette, and Green Lake counties, call Kate at 920-401-5470. For Adams and Sauk counties, call Josh at 608-322-2190. For Columbia, Dodge, and Fond du Lac counties, call Bill at 920-602-7202. For Calumet and Brown counties, call Scott at 920-530-1311.
If you care about animals or crops, you probably care how the weather could impact both.
It's summer in Wisconsin, and the success of your efforts often depends on knowing the forecast. Count on your local Civic Media weather team for all the information you need.
Crops roots are also growing deeper in search for water, which is bad news because when rain finally falls, it will sit shallow and be absorbed in the top layers of the soil.
Your weather and more for your part of Wisconsin.
On your local Civic Media radio station and streaming on the app.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba,
please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. Then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Pursuing the truth wherever it may lead. The Todd Albaugh Show, weekday afternoons from 1 till 3. Join the conversation. Get involved. The Todd Albaugh Show on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Best measure seen right here in this factory.
A building boom, a manufacturing boom, a jobs boom, a clean energy boom. Sounds like a good idea to me. For much more on all of these booms and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site formerly known as Twitter at Green News Report.
Are you tired of think tank-approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Found out our former president, nothing more than a common criminal, evidently in the eyes of the law, as his legal team negotiated for his release. Going to be about $200,000 in bail to keep him out of jail. And he's a billionaire. He can easily, I'm sure, cough that up. But, you know, here's the thing. When you've got the leader of the Republican Party having to put up $200,000 in Fulton County to keep himself out of jail, he's going to be fingerprinted. He's going to be released and booked and all of that. This isn't good. And I know there are a lot of people. I was looking at social media today. Everyone's all celebrating, tingling in the panties, happy, all that stuff. It's not good. This is not good all the way around. This, in my view, this is bad. And no, a former president slash common criminal is not a good thing for the nation. It's not. But Trump did this to himself. This is the sad reality of the moment we're in, and this is our system. And the thing is, as I was driving home from Connecticut today, because over the weekend we spent, my youngest daughter and I spent the weekend up in Bridgeport, and got to see a fabulous concert and spend the weekend together. It's something that I do with the kids. But I was thinking about, you know, January 20th of 2017 when I was coming back. And I was thinking about that day when what was ahead of us was uncertain, was going to be frightening in my view. And I remember at the time going, this is going to be bad. This will be the most corrupt administration in the history of the country. You didn't need to have a crystal ball to know that we were going to see some pretty nasty stuff. There was going to be some criming. There was going to be some, you know, some shenanigans. There's going to be lots of Twitter. We knew all of the basics. We knew it was going to be bad. My hope at the time, and for those who remember tuning in, was saying, look, if he goes the way that I hope he goes, manufacturing, infrastructure, the things that got him to, well, at least to the heart and soul of my family, who had never voted, who were always the basket of deplorables. But they voted for him because he told them they were bringing those jobs back. They were bringing back that American dream. We're going to bring back those factories. Those towns are going to have their self-pride again. This was going to be great. And people bought it. Now, as where I went the other way, I said, look, this guy's a con man. He's always been a con man. He's always going to be a con man. It's always going to be about him, and it's going to be bad. People are going to go to jail. There are going to be horrible things that happen. And I've admitted this numerous times. I don't at all pretend to have predicted how bad. I said it was going to be bad. This is going to be unimaginably bad, but not this bad. I mean, you think about it, twice impeached. Had I said on January 20th of 2017 that he was going to be impeached twice, no one would have believed it. If you would have said, you know, eventually he's going to be found guilty of rape by a jury, no one would have believed that. No one would have believed that he would have not conceded his defeat. And in fact, not just not conceded, but doubled down, claim he won, and then put into motion a scheme to hold on to power by some twisted legal theory for some crackpot lawyers. And then when that failed, no, it gets worse. Had I said I predicted any of this, well, then have a big to-do, have a bunch of people coming to the D.C. area with the intent of stopping the steal, riling them all up and pointing them at Congress and telling them, stop the steal. And then surprised that there was violence. And now, here in the aftermath of all of that, four times indicted, saying that he seeks re-election for retribution. He's going after those. He's coming back. And he would still be the head of the Republican Party. Had I said any of that stuff on January 20th, 2017, every person would have laughed at me. But this is where we are. And this is what happened. And we all, like I said, knew it was going to be bad. We knew it was all going to be destructive for the country. We knew it was all going to tear at the fabric of who and what we are. And it has. And the one thing that it has successfully done, and this is what I said back then, what it has successfully done is it has made the wealth class richer. And that's what it was always all, it's what it's always what it's about. It's always about keeping working people at each other's throats. It's at slicing and dicing and pitting us against each other. So again, they can continue to rob us blind. And they've done it masterfully. You have to give credit where credit is due. And the credit to the wealth class of this country, who have given massive tax breaks and massively deregulated our economy so that they could take advantage of it and ultimately us, and then have us blame each other. I got to tell you, it's mastery. Now, it's not just Trump. Understand, Trump is not the reason all this has happened. In fact, Trump has kind of boogered things up, to be honest, like Trump does. You know, I remember I had a friend who was one of the lawyers for the USFL Players Association. And he told the story about how Trump came into one of the negotiations and he just blew the whole thing up. They had been working for days to hammer out an agreement. He basically came in, blew it all up on the owner's side, and ended up getting the players much more than they possibly could have wanted. He screwed it up, and then ultimately screwed up the whole league. But that's what Trump does. It was all about him, nothing about the league. And it's the same thing with this country. It's nothing to do with you or me. It's nothing to do with making this a great country. It's about him. And it's always been that. So are we surprised that the news media is focused completely on the train wreck that is now our country over this one guy? Wednesday, Wisconsin, Milwaukee, there's going to be a debate. He has decided that he's not coming. And look, I wouldn't either. It's the child's table. Why would you go with Vivek Ramaswamy? Now, the governor of Iowa is saying, hey, you know, Trump's still got a campaign. No, he doesn't. Not when you have a cult status. Not when all of the things that I laid out, all of the crimes, all of the indictments, all of the impeachments, all of the everything hasn't swayed the Republican Party away from him. He's their guy. It's ride or die. And for me, this thing on Wednesday in Wisconsin, I'm not even going to pay attention to. Because why? The Republican Party is going to have to go through this Trump era in order to find who they are. Now, there's some hope. There is some hope. And, you know, as we've been talking about for quite some time, I think at some point working people get enough. I think enough of the voices that pop up that make people start to think a little bit differently and away from the cult of Trump, maybe that's a good thing. But we got to go through this. And while we're going through this, we're going to have to deal with a lot of characters. For instance, you know, when the big debate happens on Wednesday with the children at the little kids table, evidently Don Jr. and Kimberly Guilfoyle are going to be the ones who are going to attend for Donald. And if that's not a joke, I don't know what is. But you know, understand, the Republican Party seems to have lost its mind completely. I was reading a story over at The Atlantic. And one of the front runners in the child's table of the Republican primary, Vivek Ramaswamy, said, and this is how crazy things have gotten, and how much they're trying to move us away from, you know, anything that's going to help. He said, I think it is legitimate to say how many police, how many federal agents were on the planes that hit the Twin Towers. Yes, he is saying, I don't know. Maybe there were police on the. Maybe there were federal agents on those Twin Towers. You know, maybe. He said maybe the answer is zero. Maybe it's possible it's zero for all I know. Right? For all I know, it's possibly zero. I have no reason to think it was anything other than zero. I don't know. But you never know. It's this kind of craziness that is. These aren't serious people. These aren't serious politicians. These aren't people who are trying to make lives better. These are people who are trying to get attention. And when our politics turned away from how do we make people's lives better to, hey, how do I get attention? This is when things have gone off the rails. And the sad reality is we have done this to ourselves. You and me, we the voting populace have done this. I was looking at this CBS YouGov poll that asked Trump supporters who they trust more. Do they trust their family and friends? Do they trust, you know, conservative media figures like Tucker? Do they, their religious leaders? Because, you know, of course, the Republican Party hell-bent on faith and religion. Or do they believe Trump more often? And what was interesting is 71% of the people polled said they believed Trump. 63% believed friends and family. So they believe a guy that is, you know, a billionaire con man over their own families. 56% believe conservative talking heads, which I'm shocked it's that high. The one thing that caught my attention, because I understand, look, you know, they're on the Trump cult. Of course, they're going to believe Trump. They don't believe their own families. They don't believe everything they see in the media. I get that. Only 42% said they believed religious leaders over Trump. Wow. And this again is another one of these moments where you go, the fabric of this country is being torn apart. Whether you're a religious person or not, it was one of the places, one of the institutions that tried to keep people on the straight and narrow, tried to keep them, you know, good, decent, honest, however you want to frame that, being torn apart. And again, you know, Trump isn't the cause for this. He's what's accelerated it. He's what's made it go boom. The question is what are we going to do about it? How do we rebuild that American dream? How do we rebuild a future for ourselves and for our children and our grandchildren like our grandparents did? To where we believe that if you worked hard, you played by the rules, you got ahead. How do we rebuild that? I keep saying it comes down to sound, smart policy, sound investment. Something I think Joe Biden is doing very well. And when we come back and to talk about my trip back from Connecticut, I got to share some thoughts. But I want to hear your thoughts as well. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So over the weekend, my youngest daughter and I went up to Bridgeport, Connecticut to spend the weekend together, see a concert, spend some time, you know, roaming around, exploring the city. Bridgeport, a beautiful place. Showed up for the jazz festival they had over the weekend, a wonderful opportunity for community, for people to come together. It was fabulous. And we had a great weekend in Connecticut. And good, again, Connecticut's one of those states where, you know, the haves versus the have-nots. It's one of the more unequal states in the country. And for me, I spent a lot of time thinking about how do we rebuild that prosperous working class? How do we make that opportunity there again? And the thing is, as we were heading to and from, we ended up going over the replacement of the Tappan Zee Bridge, which is now the Mario Cuomo Bridge, which I prefer the Tappan Zee, to be honest. But it's a beautiful structure, done with all union labor under a project labor agreement with Davis-Bacon, protections in place, created good jobs, money in the, but more importantly, done on time, under budget, and done. That's the other part, done. Unlike that monstrosity out in California that wasn't done with a PLA, with the Davis-Bacon protections, which is probably never going to be finished. But it got me thinking about, as I was driving both ways, and, oh, by the way, Joe Biden, I'm ticked at you. The traffic was, oh, my gosh, because there were little cones all over the place. Now, again, long-term thinking, great stuff. We're investing in infrastructure. We're rebuilding the roads because the roads in that area, not great. But lots of construction going on. Made my commute a little more troubling. But here's the thing. You know, this infrastructure boom is creating really good jobs. And some of the media reports out of this is, you know, today, for instance, Biden announced another $667 million in new grants and loans to go into rural broadband. This should make rural communities thrilled by the fact that we're actually, I don't know, moving into the 21st century. And they're saying, look, you know, the reality is where we are. We need more workers. We need more people who are going to be able to do the jobs that are going to build this infrastructure, this incredible infrastructure. And I kept thinking about all those people I saw, you know, doing the work, the wages I know that they're earning, the benefits I know that they're getting, and it being, I hope, the start of rebuilding a prosperous working class. I keep talking about the reality that we need those good paying, family sustaining jobs, the kind that my grandparents' generation enjoyed and fought for. Not enjoyed, fought for, demanded, and something we should be doing again. But there was tons of it. Now, I did on the way back drive past Bedminster. Because today, if you remember, and I got to throw this out there, today was supposed to be the conclusive report proving Trump's innocence. And I drove past the golf club there in Bedminster and no one was home. But like I said, lots of construction traffic, no conclusive report. Let's quick go to the phones. I've got Dan from Chicago on line one. Dan, how are you?
Hey, Rick, how's it going?
I'm good. What's on your mind, brother?
Doing well. I want to just compliment what you were saying about how Joe Biden has probably been one of the more effective presidents in terms of getting blue-collar jobs back to individuals and also building things made in America, which is exactly what all of the Republicans have been asking for, yet we still hate him for doing those things, apparently. But I did want to talk about, Joan was talking about today that, you know, whether or not Donald Trump is in prison or not, or if he suffers some type of a medical issue. And maybe Joe Biden does not want to run at this point because he thinks that he's the only one that could beat Donald Trump at this point. J.B. Pritzker is a name that keeps popping up among individuals. I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
I think he would be a good choice. I've said before, my choice would be, I like Gretchen Whitmer. I like her a lot.
I love her.
I can see a future Gretchen Whitmer, Josh Shapiro ticket. You know, one of my favorite people politically on the planet is Sherrod Brown. I would love to see that. There are a lot of great names out there. J.B. Pritzker being one of them. I think as a governor, he's done a pretty good job for you guys in Illinois.
I think he's been really good, and he can actually self-fund for most of it, which is probably half the battle.
I got to tell you, that's not a driver for me. I don't want to find hope in billionaires.
No, I agree with you completely, but that seems to be the trend these days. I feel that we need to reform our election laws, and people shouldn't be able to self-fund their own election campaigns. But that seems to be, thanks to the Supreme Court, the way that things are working these days.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I don't care if Joe Biden runs or not. I love Joe Biden, but it's his policies I want. I want what he's been doing to continue.
Exactly.
The end of neoliberalism, you know, I've been calling for a couple of decades now. Finally, we're moving. We're not there yet, but we're moving in that direction. And for me, that's hugely exciting.
I think he's been pretty effective. I didn't vote for him in the primary, but I fell in line and voted for him in the general. And he's been one of the most effective presidents that I've seen. I'm only 36, but still, I mean, he knows how to get things done.
I'm 20 years older than you, and he was my fourth choice. But everything that he's been doing is stuff I've been calling for all that time. So for me, I'm glad to see it happening.
Yeah. Well, listen, Rick, I love your show. I have a show on WCPT Sunday mornings from 8 to 9 a.m. It's called Apolitini.
All right.
And if any of your listeners want to tune in, they are more than welcome to.
There you go. Appreciate it, Dan.
Yeah. But thanks. I love your show. It's great. I listen to it every night.
Thanks so much. Good stuff, Dan. No, but here's the thing, and this is where you know, the important part, you know, what Dan brought up here. It's the policies for me. I don't get into cult of personality. I've never been into hero worship. I've never said, hey, this person is going to save us. And this is what Trump brought us. I alone can do it. And no, you alone can't do it. What you've done is you've caused massive, massive chaos. And we need to be answering some of the questions that are going to help us move in a direction that's going to make lives better. And one of the things that I've said is, you know, what Biden has done, I think, really well is go after some of those policies that allowed manufacturing to leave, start talking about an industrial policy, start talking about, you know, how are we going to provide a future for our kids? And the fact that he's all in on the union front, and that's how we're going to replace, we're going to rebuild the working class. For me, that's great stuff. Let's quick go to the phones. Got Joe on two. Joe, how are you?
I'm good, Rick. How are you?
I'm great. What's on your mind, brother?
Hey, just, you know, I live in Chicago. I'm a union electrician, been an electrician for over 30 years. But, you know, you talk a lot about, you know, the wages and all that, and yeah, I think it's deeper than that, because we all like to go to the diners. And how is a diner supposed to pay somebody living wages when living wages is gone? I mean, isn't it gone?
Yeah, no, I'm with you. This what I keep saying, Joe, and you're. I hope you're gonna back me up on this. By paying good wages to our construction workers, that money goes into those diners and reverberates through the local economy and is churned through and helps build up by us using our tax dollars to build these projects and pay good wages doing it. It helps all of the community. That's my view. What do you see?
Well, I just see, you know, I make good money. I can't complain, right? I'm a union electrician in Chicago. Yep. I can't complain. Chicago is a great city. It's very livable. You know, I actually live in the city, but you know, I go to these diners and I see these waitresses, and I like to go to the the ones with cash only and stuff like that. But I always look and go, you know, how do these women, you know, because it's mostly women that are serving, how do they, you know, if they don't have a husband, it's, you know, how are they surviving? Because rent, you know, my son lives a couple of blocks away from us, and he's got a two-flat. He rents it out for almost $2,000, an apartment for almost $2,000 a month.
That's crazy.
How does somebody afford that?
No, I'm right there with you. In fact, my next guest is going to answer some of those questions. We're going to talk about some of that in the next segment. I got to take a quick break here, Joe, but I appreciate the call, brother. I hope you'll call back again soon. But when we come back, you may remember I was talking about a video of this Jessica McCabe from Alabama, the mother of two adult children who, you know, she said exactly what Joe said. How do you afford to live? How do you afford to rent an apartment when the prices are just completely outrageous? In fact, the video went completely viral, some 12, 13 gazillion views. We're going to have her up next to share some thoughts on her video and, you know, what inspired it, why, and all of that. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day National Guard troops in Minneapolis raided Teamsters Local 574 headquarters. Over 150 were arrested, including top strike leaders Bill Brown and the Dunn brothers, who were imprisoned in military stockades. Troops also seized union records and files. They then raided the Central Labor Union and forcing out dozens of area labor leaders. The Teamsters had been battling the trucking bosses and the Citizens Alliance throughout the spring and summer in what would be a turning point for industrial organizing. Finally, drivers agreed to a tentative settlement, but the bosses rejected any deal, refusing to negotiate with Reds. Farmer Labor Party Governor Floyd Olson declared martial law the next day. 4,000 troops arrived, issuing unlimited military permits to scab drivers. By month's end, over 7,500 scab trucks were rolling throughout the city. Local 574 challenged the martial law, demanding that peaceful picketing and open-air meetings be reinstated. They also wanted troops withdrawn from the city, and they wanted all truck movement halted for 48 hours. When Olson rejected these demands, a mass rally was called for the 31st to mobilize strike support. 25,000 turned out to the parade grounds, cheering strike leader Bill Brown, who declared, quote, "The Farmer Labor Party is the best strike-breaking force our union has ever gone up against." Historian Brian Palmer notes, the loudest and longest applause was reserved for Albert Goldman, who thundered, quote, "If we submit without a struggle, then we deserve the fate of submissive slaves. We cannot, we dare not submit. We call upon the workers, organized and unorganized, to clench their fists, shout defiance of the bosses, and struggle until victory or death."
Today's train robbers don't need guns, for they are railroad executives wearing $3,000 suits and robbing us by railroading the political system. With their gangs of lobbyists and hopper cars of campaign cash, they get Congress to do their dirty work, gutting public safety protections and muting railway unions. Thus, rich investors get richer, while regular people are hit by an astonishing level of derailments, injuries, destruction, and death. Witness the horrific wreck of Norfolk Southern's nearly 2-mile-long toxic freight train this year in East Palestine, Ohio. This was a product of the industry's prevailing ethic of profit over public safety, and the American people were outraged by the greed, demanding fundamental reform. U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg weighed in, correctly noting that calls to protect the public have too often, quote, "given way to industry pushback and inaction. That must not happen this time," he emphatically declared. You go, Pete. But it is happening. A key reform he pushed was to allow rail employees to report safety dangers without fear of retribution from the corporate hierarchy. Such a close-call reporting program has existed for years, but participation was voluntary. Hello. Out of some 800 American railroad corporations, just 27 chose to volunteer, and all of the big 8 freight giants, including Norfolk Southern, refused to join. In the media glare of the East Palestine catastrophe, however, nearly all pledged to support the employee reporting reform. But that was then. Today, the media focus on East Palestine is gone, and the railroad lobbyists and their hopper cars of corporate cash have rolled back into Washington, watering down Buttigieg's safety agreement to nothing. This is Jim Hightower saying, and that's why America's train system won't run right until we fix the crooked political money system that derails progress.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you may remember a couple of weeks ago, we talked about a video that a woman from Alabama made about her two adult children, you know, just trying to start their lives and how difficult it has been for them. And you may remember, I was not overly kind, you know, because I did ask the question, you know, when did this pop up? When did you realize that it's not 1985 anymore? And look, I said, look, this is great. The party that figures out who to address her concerns is going to get her loyalty and, you know, millions of other voters across the country as well, because for far too long, the wants, needs, and hopes and dreams of the working class have been left way off the table. And so we reached out to Jessica McCabe and said, hey, you know, would you like to come on the show and talk with us? And, well, lo and behold, she said yes, and she's here to share some thoughts with us. Jessica, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
So this video, great stuff, as I talked about before, pointing out the realities of where we are. When did you realize that things aren't great? When did you have this moment of clarity that it's not 1985 anymore?
I think for me, and it's not an excuse by far, any way, shape, or form, but I was in the military for 22 years. So I didn't really have to deal with rent. I had base housing. You know, I didn't have to deal with the cost of health insurance because I had military health care. You know, so I joined the military at 19. I was on my own since I was 16 because I could. You know, even my wage was only $4.85. I was able to live on my own at 16 years old. So I just didn't see it until my kids aged out of my health insurance, which was through the military, and then they started to try to get out on their own. And there was even times when I was overseas. I didn't see what was going on in America. I didn't have to worry about the inflation here because I wasn't here. You know, we were in Japan. I was in Korea. So I was all over the place. And all I knew is that I got a paycheck the 1st and the 15th of every month. I always had a roof over my head with my kids, and we didn't have to worry about medical insurance. So not until they aged out and I retired from the military did I see the world as it was.
So it's when it directly affected you.
Correct.
Because one of the questions I didn't realize, and thanks for your service, I didn't realize you were a military, lifelong military person. So that explains a lot of being in kind of a bubble, as you pointed out. But you brought up the word inflation, and I'm hearing a lot of that. You know, everyone's saying, well, it's the inflation. Well, inflation is part of it. The bigger part for me has always been the fact that if you look at CEO compensation to worker compensation from 1978 to today, their wages have gone up 1,000%. Ours have gone up 12%. So that prices are going up, wages, unfortunately, haven't, because these big corporations, these CEOs, and of course, our politicians have done a hell of a job holding wages down.
Oh, well, we have not increased the federal minimum wage since 2009. And it's not because the people didn't want it. It's because it would always go to Congress, and Republicans and Democrats would always stall it in the House. And why? Because the people who they're actually working for, in my opinion, are their benefactors, which are the donors. So if you raise the minimum wage, then you lower CEO bonuses and profit margins. So it didn't benefit them, the people who are actually paying for them to be in office, to do so. And now they're saying that if they raised it, that it would put us into a lot of inflation. Well, you're right. If you raised it right now from the 725 to what it should be accounting for inflation, it would kill our economy. But if you had been doing it in increments every time the inflation went up, it wouldn't be such hard hitting as it is today.
So now when you say something like this, obviously you've gotten, because of the viral video, you've gotten a lot of people probably on both sides of the extremes, you know, attacking you or praising you.
Correct.
What are they saying to you?
Well, I have obviously some millennials and Gen Z saying, thank God somebody in your generation finally gets it. You know, we're out here struggling and it's not 1985 anymore. But on the flip side, although I do have some Generation X and boomers that are agreeing as well, the biggest pushback that I'm having is from the boomers and Gen Xers saying, well, they just need to work harder or get a better job. And, you know, we did this and I did it. They should be able to do it. Well, you're correct. If we were still in the same economy as 1985, we're not there anymore.
Yeah. No. And look, you know, I go back to the 1985 era. I'm a union guy. Union density in this country was over 20%, close to 25%. Mm-hmm. It's down to, in the private sector, 6.6%, which means the ability for people to fight for better wages, hours, and conditions has been diminished over the last 25, 30 years in incredible ways. So that view of I'll just go across the street and get a different job, a better paying job, isn't there because, well, reality is they are colluding and holding wages down on purpose.
Well, and I think more and more of this generation, the millennials and Gen Zs, they don't feel a need to stay with a company long like we did. We're like, oh, if we stay there for 20 years, we're going to get a pension. There's going to be something at the end of the tunnel. And it's because we felt like the company was committed to us and we were committed to them. And I don't think that's the case anymore. You know, they'll just as soon as let you go in 5 seconds if they feel like their profit margins are going down. They don't care about the family unit or even the middle class as it is. And it's just, I don't see my kids being able to retire like when I did. I don't see a retirement in their future at all if something doesn't change.
No, I think you're absolutely right. But don't you think that a lot of that generation, both the millennials and especially Gen Z, are looking at the treatment that corporate America gave their parents and the screw job that Gen X has taken over these years? And we don't talk about that at all. We've been suffering in silence as downsizing and outsourcing and consolidation have destroyed what was that thing that was able for us to build up. But fortunately, we still had it. Now the kids don't even have the beginnings of that.
No, and honestly, it's not going to get better with the outsourcing. When just look at Walmart. I mean, just walking into Walmart, they've gotten rid of half the cashiers, which was jobs, to be now we're bagging our own groceries and saying, thank you for letting me do it. You know, so it's everywhere you look, they in McDonald's, right? They're just getting rid of the middle class. Like they're going to find some other way to have it work for them and have more profits. And middle class are stuck going, what do I do now? Yeah. That's why you have so many social media influencers right now, because that's what corporations are paying for. It's the quick buck. But what is that going to do for them in the long run? They're not going to have a 401k being an influencer. You know, once they're no longer popular, they no longer have a job. So they're going to these unsustainable jobs because companies don't care about them anymore.
Yeah, but you talk about 401k. I'm still hoping we go back to defined benefits, to where people work 40 years, get a gold watch and a pension that lasts their lifetime. And again, that's the difference in thinking between someone in Gen X. I'm a early Gen X, and you know the next generations, they don't even know what a defined benefit pension is. They've been gone for so long because corporate America has so badly screwed the working class of this country over.
Oh, I definitely agree. And you know, if we're going to do anything, I mean, I think what we forget as a people is that the big corporations and the elitists are trying to pin us together, and they're doing a very good job, because instead of fighting with the people that we should be fighting with, we are fighting amongst ourselves. We are finding everything to be divisive about, Republican, Democrat. And I'm like, do you really think either party is really pushing for the people? I mean, this is a Democratic and Republican problem because it's a people problem. So why are we not saying, hey, let's all band together and look at them and demand that you start representing us and stop representing the big corporations that are paying for your campaign? And I think if we put some things into place that maybe put some things to where certain people couldn't vote, to me, it's a conflict of interest. If a big corporation gives you millions of dollars to put you in power, who are you working for?
Yeah.
Are you working for me, the people, or are you working for that person that gave you millions of dollars to get in that position?
So you'd have a problem with, you know, say something like Clarence Thomas making a decision on the Supreme Court, you know, when billionaires have paid for his vacations.
Correct. Like, that's a conflict of interest. So why are we still allowing to do that in the United States? Term limits. We've wanted term limits since 1995, and 23 states tried to enact term limits. And then a senator from Arkansas says, oh no, because then that would mean that I'm not getting my kickbacks. He fought it. Then they ended up taking it to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court says that only the Constitution can change term limits.
Yeah.
Who has to approve an amendment to the Constitution?
The people.
Ultimately. You know, so like, why aren't we doing something?
See,
you know,
but I'm actually not in favor of term limits, because I think we have the ultimate term limiter. We as educated, informed, active, engaged voters can go to the polls and throw these bums out anytime we want. The sad reality is, and you hit on it a second ago, we're so well sliced and diced and pitted against each other that we're not even talking about issues anymore. We're stuck in the red hat, blue hat category. Where we've now defined ourselves by who we voted for and which color shirt we're wearing, instead of what policies we need to make our lives and our kids' lives better. And that's how they've gotten us. And they've gotten us good. I mean, to be honest, the massive wealth redistribution that's happened in this country from the working poor and the working class to our hyper wealthy at the top is mind-blowingly incredible.
Oh, and it's there. I mean, it's like they're doing it right in front of our face. And we see it, but we're too blind to see it either because, A, we don't want to believe that this is actually happening to the America that we grew up in, or we don't know what to do about it, so we're just going to be blissfully ignorant about what's going on. And I look at some of those things today, and like you said, I made a video the other day that people now are being judged by their political affiliation instead of their character. And I will always judge people by their character, but we can no longer do that. Back in the 80s, nobody talked about who you voted for. You know, there could be people within the same family that were Democrat and Republican, and you judge somebody on their character, how they treated you, how they treated people in their communities. But now it's like, I'm not going to help you if you don't believe exactly everything that I believe in. It's either you're with me or against me, instead of saying we are all in this together. So why aren't we helping each other out? Because we are stronger together.
Let me ask you this, because I made a comment a little bit earlier. And I said, look, the sad reality is we've got people who get into politics because they want attention, not so much they want to help people. I mean, I look at the Republican Party right now, and I'm going to be quite open and honest about it. I say they hate working people. Just look at the things that they do. Look at the policies that they've put into place over the last 40 years. Look at the destruction of program after program. And we could debate that forever, but I don't see any policy initiatives coming from that side of the aisle to do what you said, raise the minimum wage, to make sure that people get health care, to address housing concerns, because all of this stuff we can, with smart policy and sound investment, address as our grandparents' generation did.
Oh, most definitely. And I think that that's what we're missing. I mean, right there, when's the last time a common American decided just to go and read a bill? Like, read the 82 pages of a bill. We don't. You know what we read? We read the headline. And they put the headline as what we want to hear. So it'd be like, oh, we're going to get rid of student debt loans. So we're going to put that as a headline. But what you don't realize, in that bill, they've patted each other's backs and said, okay, we're going to put this bill, but we're also going to add this into it. And we don't see it. So we're like, yes, we want you to vote for that bill. We do. And then other things that we didn't read are actually going to affect our future. So how would they have so much power to just add things into a bill that none of us see?
Corporate lobbyists.
Yes.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Jessica McCabe. You can check her out on Twitter. I mean, on TikTok, right? You got like a huge TikTok following. Like,
yes, it's like, on TikTok.
Like almost a million people, right?
I think it's 780,000.
Good for you. Because look, we need more people who are going to have the kind of voice that you've got on this. So let me ask you, you know, how do we address this? I mean, you ask questions about housing. You said, you know, why is it that, you know, housing costs $2,000 a month for an apartment? Why do you think that is?
Well, why are we letting foreign governments buy land in America that don't even live here? It's like they're parking their money here in the United States. Why are we letting big corporations buy out all, like, a lot of the inventory and then putting it directly for rent? So it's like they're saying, you will never own anything. You will rent and you will pay our mortgages so that we can sell it later and you'll be happy about it. You know, so unfortunately, when these big companies come in and buy houses and raise the rent, the regular person that bought an investment property, which there's no wrong way to buy an investment property, they're going, wait, well, if this is going for $2,000, I can also sell it for $2,000 because I need it because this inflation is killing me. So they rise up the rent, meaning the big corporations, and make the other people who are just doing investment properties, blue collar, that just want to make a little extra money, they do the same thing.
See, I got to tell you, I was expecting a different answer. I got to tell you, Jessica, I thought we were going to argue. I thought we were going to disagree on a lot of stuff. But, you know, this is the thing about Gen Xers. We find common ground. So how do we get the rest of Gen X to realize that it was our generation who led the slide downward? We grew up in the era of greed is good, the one with the most toys when he dies wins, when that hooray for me mentality. How do we come back to the idea that smart policy, sound investment is the way forward? We can address all of our problems if we figure out how to come off the sidewalks yelling at each other and come back to the streets?
Like I told my kids, the way I really found out was I lived like my kids. You know, so I actually went out with them, looked at apartments. I actually looked at their budget with them, you know, and they showed me all these things. And I'm like, oh my gosh, it like really opened up my eyes. And I felt guilty for going on a vacation, you know, because me and my husband could afford it, you know, and here's my daughter working 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, 8 months pregnant, just to try to put food on the table. And I'm like, holy, you know, so when you start seeing that, and you have to have empathy. Us as Gen Xers are supposed to make, every generation is supposed to make the next generation better than the one we just came from. So when did we lose that lesson?
No, and I'm glad you brought that up, because, you know, I say all the time, you know, we grew up believing, and I'm sure you'll agree, that if you worked hard, you played by the rules, you got ahead. And right. That, you know, this idea that it was our birthright almost, that each mm-hmm. generation would do just a little bit better than the previous generation. And that seems to have stalled. And a lot of it comes back to the greed that we see in our corporate boardrooms, the bad policy that's been allowed to be put in place over the last 40 years. And our, I got to be honest, our ability to allow ourselves to be sliced and diced and pitted against each other.
Oh, I agree. You know, and I think that we got used to being kind of spoiled, meaning if out of sight, out of mind. If we didn't see it, if it didn't affect us, if we were still able to go on our vacations, if we still had our 401ks, then we're like, okay, well, I'm fine. Everybody else should be fine. You know, so if you don't see it, you don't realize there's a problem to change it. You know, and I think that if we just have a little bit of empathy and start lifting up the next community, can you imagine how much stronger this world would be if we actually worked together and tried to make it a better place to be?
Oh. Heaven forbid, can't have that, because then, well, then, you know, no Jeff Bezos, no Elon Musk's.
No, you wouldn't. No. You know, and it's literally turning into, like I said, the ultra wealthy and then everybody else. Yeah. Everybody else outnumbers the ultra wealthy. So why aren't we doing something?
Yeah, again, I say this all the time. They've got all the money, but we've out-procreated them. If we would right. just come together on some simple ideas, you know, maybe. But there was a guy back in 2004 ran on this platform of the Two Americas. You may remember him. John Edwards said, eventually we're going to end up in a place where you've got the haves and the have nots. And sadly, mm-hmm. it appears that we have made that that reality. But Jessica, last question I've got for you. How do we get people like you to run for something? You know, how do we get people like just average, everyday working people to come out and go, you know what? We're going to go to Washington, or we're going to go to Montgomery, or we're going to go to Harrisburg, or we're going to go wherever. And we're going to make those 82 page laws. And what's going to say inside of them is we're going to help working people. We're going to help mothers so they don't have to work into their eighth month of being pregnant. We're going to help families get by so that they want to bring children to this world. How do we get you to run for something?
Well, I think nobody can do that alone. And I think that's the problem. When you go into government, you go in there with nice ideals, but then the greed monster kind of takes over and you become self-serving. So the only way to not be self-serving is to be with the people before. I mean, you have to be in the trenches with the people while you're making those rules.
Well, good stuff, Jessica. I appreciate you taking time for us. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks so much. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Back with your thoughts after this. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1893. That was the day that workers' rights and women's rights activist and anarchist Emma Goldman gave a speech in New York City. Emma Goldman was born in what is today Lithuania. She came to New York in 1885, where she built a reputation as a powerful speaker. In New York, she addressed a crowd of between 3 and 4,000 unemployed workers in Union Square. The country was at the beginning of a depression that would sweep across the nation. Working families were finding it harder and harder to put food on the table. By the end of 1893, unemployment would soar to nearly 20%. Undercover agents at the rally reported that Emma had urged the crowd to take bread from the capitalists, quote, by force. Goldman recounted saying, quote, well then, demonstrate before the palaces of the rich, demand work.
If they do not give you work, demand bread. If they deny you both, take bread. 10 days later, Emma was arrested in Philadelphia for her comments at the New York rally. She was sentenced to 1 year in prison. After she was released, Emma traveled to Vienna to study medicine. She returned to the United States to continue her lectures on workers and women's rights. She spoke out about the need for women to have access to contraception, an opinion that could arouse a backlash at the time. Emma was arrested multiple times for daring to speak out on controversial issues. In 1919, during the height of the Red Scare anti-communist hysteria, Emma Goldman was deported to the Soviet Union. Emma was a courageous defender of free speech, often called the most dangerous woman in America. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I gotta tell you, I really liked her. Again, we need more voices like that to step out of the darkness and say, look, life's tough. You know, the kids are struggling. It wasn't like this for us. And as Jessica said, look, I was making $4.35 an hour back then, able to afford a place to live, a crummy car, was able to get by. And the reality is, you know, inflation has gone up. But consolidation has been a huge part of this. You know, I remember my first apartment, I think I paid $135 a month for when I was in college. You know, granted, minimum wage was $3.35 an hour back then, but you know, that isn't $1,200, $1,500 a month on a $7.25 minimum wage. And there were more diverse, more unionized jobs, more opportunities than there are currently. Everyone now wants gig employment. Everyone now, you're going to be your own boss. And this idea that, you know, again, I think my generation, and I'm going to speak for the whole generation at this point, believed that if you work hard, you play by the rules, you're going to get ahead. That's just the equation. That was what was laid out in front of us. And that the harder you worked, the meritocracy idea, the harder you worked, the better off you were going to be. We believed that. We internalized it. And you talk to people of our generation, and it comes out in all of the rhetoric. That has changed, and has changed in enormous ways. Now, again, I got a couple of emails from folks, and too many to go through at this moment. But some of it going, well, you know, again, the divisive stuff. Well, you know, it was great for white men, but not for women or, you know, minorities, or, you know, I got all that. And I agree. Question is how do we take all of this stuff that has been dividing us for so long? How do we take all of this stuff, learn from it, and move forward? Because here's the weird thing. This is the spot that I've been in for a while. I don't know how you get past the divisive stuff. I don't know how you get past the hard barriers that people throw up. Well, this is my issue. How do you get past that? You know, I brought up the song about the guy that sang the song last week, that evidently is all over the country music charts. I asked the question of, you know, when you hear that song, you know, where do you put yourself? Because the responses I got from people, well, he's being racist, or he's being this, or he's being that. And I hear a guy who's saying, look, life's tough. Wages are crummy. I'm struggling, working my behind off, not getting ahead. And there's a point at which people go, well, what's the point of working if you're not going to get ahead? What's the point of my struggles and my labor and my, you know, the ache of my back and the sweat of my brow not being able to keep a roof over my head? You know, it was about, I guess it's been about 15 years now, where we had done a food drive. The idea was we're going to help the food bank and the homeless shelter. So we did a hungry and homeless for the holiday food drive. And I guess it just shows to my privilege that I didn't realize that people who were in the homeless shelters actually held full-time jobs. I mean, it makes sense when you stop and you think about it, that, you know, it's possible that people who work could be homeless. But I was surprised by the number of people in the homeless shelter who worked at all of our establishments that you didn't know that they were homeless. They came, they did their job, and then they went back to nowhere. And in what society is that sane or rational? And then you have people who are going to say, well, you know, yeah, we can't possibly raise the minimum wage. What kind of a society do we want?